And you got to keep fighting the feeling, the doom and gloom feeling. The doom and gloom feeling. And you got to keep fighting the feeling. The doom and gloom feeling.
Hello and welcome to another episode of my favorite podcast, and hopefully yours, It's Never Sunny in Seattle. Episode number 83 is here, and we're excited to talk everything Mariners baseball. Mikey Ahedo is on the line with me. Mikey, episode number 100 is starting to sneak up on us. We're at 83 right now, and episode number 100 should happen sometime in late August, if my counting is correct. Do you have any ideas for our 100th episode special?
Yeah, we got to get Norm Charlton on the line.
Is he like easy to get a hold of?
I don't know. Jay Buhner.
Honestly, I am thinking it would be cool to have like a really big guest for episode number 100. And I've been trying to think of who is attainable. I know if Day was here, unfortunately, Day can't be on the recording with us today. But if Day was here, I think I know who he would want to have as a special guest. And maybe this is like rude or presumptuous, but I do feel like if we really launched a campaign, we could maybe talk to Colton Wong. But I don't know. He's probably got better things to do, right? He's definitely got better things to do.
Do you think it would be interesting? Like, do you think we would talk to him and it would be like, I'm glad I listened to that?
No, but I do think, like, if I'm being honest, no. Like, I know me. If I wasn't there, like, I think if Day is there and you're there, there will be some good content created. But if it was me that was kind of like at the helm and responsible, I don't know. Probably not.
I've thought about reaching out to players before and have not yet, because I was like, I don't think I'm a good interviewer. The first time I met Paul Sewald, I think I've said this on this podcast, but I tend to not be like put people on a pedestal. At the end of the day, I know Paul Sewald is just a guy who throws a baseball real good. But when he gave me like a fist pound or whatever, I was just like, I think he was like, how's it going? Whatever. And I was like, I don't know. We had a very normal conversation.
Right. And a conversation is one thing, but an interview is pretty complicated. I really got to tell this story fast. Mikey is probably going to hate this, but for the oldest version of our podcast, how old were we? We were probably, you know, about 19 or so. And I decided it would be great to try to include some non-Mariners, but more just Seattle-centric content in general. And I wanted to include some Seattle music talk in that. So we found, or I guess I found, a local Seattle artist whose music I'd never really listened to before. And I didn't even know anything about her, but we just kind of reached out to her and her team. And we were like, hey, do you want to be on our random podcast? We're 19 years old. And I can't give you any concrete details on how that turned out, but I know it turned out really, really bad. And I hope that doesn't exist in the world anymore. I'm pretty sure it doesn't.
Do you remember her name?
I do.
Are you going to say it?
I'm just not going to say it, though. I think it was V. Contreras.
Ah, that's what it was. Okay. I was going to say Veronica.
It might be Veronica, but she goes by V.
I remember two or three things. One of the songs that she... There was a music video she had that was very sensual.
And we were just like... We were just like 19 and like horny, and she was like, why am I here?
Okay,
and we
come
were like,
on.
Dude, no, we don't know.
No, we weren't.
You said the music video is sensual.
Because it objectively was her and a dude just like hooking up. Anyways.
That's fine.
That was,
you can do that.
One thing, the song. I can't keep my shit together.
It's the podcast stance that it's fine to be sensual. All right. We know that's controversial, but we stand by it.
So that's number one. Number two, I think included in that, the song was pretty good. I actually, like, after that podcast, like, started listening to it a little bit. Two is that my Wi-Fi dropped during
the- Oh my God. Yeah. We were so unprofessional. So the idea is we are going to need to level up our interviewing game before we attempt to get anybody too important on the show. But I think you and Day are very good. And I, speaking for myself, I think I would do it much better now that I'm an actual, like, human adult person. So
she did have a very cool story about Griffey, meeting Griffey.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was relevant to the show. And speaking of relevant to the show, should we turn in a direction that is relevant to the show? I'd like to talk a little bit about the City Connect uniforms. Mm. We talked about them on our previous episode, but now that we've actually seen them in person, I think it's a good time to check in on our feelings. If I remember correctly, we were mixed, a little bit negative on the jerseys. They were, at least speaking for myself, they were mainly just disappointing, kind of bland, and a little bit too close to throwbacks and old Pilots jerseys we've been seeing. I went to the game on Friday, so I saw them in person, and the black pants, it's true. I didn't get it at first, but now that I saw them in person, they make everybody look really little, you know? From where I was sitting, they looked kind of stumpy. They made everybody's legs look really small. Luis Castillo especially, I don't know. They're fine, but maybe we can ditch the black pants for something else. What do you think, Mikey?
My official opinion is that some players make them look very decent, and some players make them look very bad. Trying to think of examples, I think one of the things I said is high socks would make them look better. Eugenio Suarez did not look great in them. Luis Castillo did not look great in them. I'm trying to think of other, like, Colton Wong looked pretty solid.
Okay, you know what I think? You know what I think the X factor is, and this is relevant to Colton Wong. I think having the yellow accents on your accessories is really what changes it. So, if I remember correctly, Colton was rocking the yellow shoes. He had the yellow, like, shin guard, the yellow elbow pad, and I think that breaks up the color blocking and a lot of the darkness of the pants in a way where it's like, okay, now that's flattering. That looks good. I went to the game on Friday with my partner, and she's not a baseball fan, so the comments on the game when we're at the game, you know, relatively scant. We're not talking about the game that much, but at some point she just looks up at Colton Wong's picture on the scoreboard and, you know, apropos of nothing, she just says, "That guy looks like Lionel Richie."
Oh.
I was like, okay, he kind of does.
I could, if you're looking at the right picture.
Yeah, it just his player picture, you know, the standard one that is up on everything, like on his player page, and that goes up on the big screen and everything. He low-key looks like Lionel Richie a little bit in that picture.
But Colton Wong, the person, does not look like Lionel Richie.
No, not at all.
Yeah. Before we get into Bryce Miller, true or false, or something in between, I don't know, maybe 1 to 10. The statement is the city of Seattle has a good food scene.
-5. No, I'm kidding. I am generally pretty disappointed in a lot of the food scene here in Seattle. I think there are some other major cities where I go, like I'll say Vancouver and Portland, just to keep it PNW. Both of those cities, Vancouver especially, has incredible food. And they have a lot of the same, like, they have a lot of the same, like, food diversity that we have here, too. I think, like, demographically, their population is pretty similar to here. I will say, though, I've been to some other large U.S. cities where I'm like, oh, this is how bad it could be. Like, I don't want to shit too hard on some cities, like, you know, let's say Cincinnati as an example. But, you know, I think it did give me a little bit of perspective and be like, okay, Seattle's food is disappointing, it could be worse, and we do at least have diversity. Yeah, what are your thoughts, Mikey?
Okay, because Day posted that picture of those shitty ass nachos and
nachos.
Oh god, that I don't even know if you can call them that.
Abominable food picture I've ever seen in my life. Oh my god, it was like a cracker with like some cheese, like. Oh man.
Anyways,
go look at that on Day's Twitter, so you have a reference for what we're talking about, because it really is abysmal.
And so that's the thing with me is most of the newer spots, chic, not good. A lot of the like older places are starting to get displaced or like, you know, shut down. And I think that if I want good food, I'm going to go to like Burien or like Renton or not the city, you know? Rainier.
Hell yeah, dude. A lot. Yeah, yeah. A lot of the best like non-bougie restaurants are moving out to the suburbs. So yeah, you're totally right. Burien. I know this is still part of Seattle, but White Center has some great food. Yeah, that's a great call. Are there any places you want to shout out?
Oh,
no,
man.
No free ads, but
McKenny's Papanga special in Renton, Filipino food, and just so good. I love that place. And if you like guns, it's right by a gun store. Anyways, Bryce Miller.
Okay. Well, speaking of people who like guns, Bryce Miller had two excellent starts. He's shown us why his promotion necessitated an emergency episode of the podcast earlier this week. So over two starts, he's gone 12 innings, struck out 15, allowed only one run, and created about 1 billion rotations on the baseball over that time. I'm actually going to read this tweet real fast from Alex Mayer at AlexMayer34 on Twitter. Bryce Miller is the first pitcher in MLB history with a sub-1 ERA, 15-plus strikeouts, and one or fewer walks over a pitcher's first two career games. Now, there's a lot of qualifiers in that statement, so that kind of dilutes the impact of the fun fact, but I think the fact is fun nonetheless, and that just really shows what Bryce Miller has done over his first two starts has been amazing. Right, Mikey?
Yeah. I mean, this has pretty much gone as well as it possibly could have. You know, I think the analysis, had we recorded post first start, would be couched in the fact that he pitched against the A's, but he also did very, very well against the Astros, who are not the Astros of yesteryear, but still very good. And metrically, like, he's pretty insane. He's throwing his fastball like 70-80% of the time, and it's just such a good pitch.
One thing I do want to say about his start against the A's, I know they're a bad team, and people were trying to use that to sort of ding his debut and say it was less than legitimate because it was against such a bad team. But it's important to remember that the A's offense is not actually that bad. I think so far, by most metrics, they've been about middle of the pack. It's their pitching that has really done the A's in so far. So, you know, to say, oh, his first start, not that impressive because it's against a bad team. The A's can hit decently. It's not like it's a AAA team. And even so, we've seen plenty of amazing pitchers still scuffle against the A's. So I don't think it's really fair to discount it. And yeah, as you said, we got to see another start today against the Astros, and he shoved. So I'm very excited.
Yeah. And I think now, like, we have data now. With his fastballs averaging 20.9 induced vertical break, I think that's the highest of any starting pitcher. And yeah, so there's a couple things I'm thinking about. One, yeah, it's his fastball. I'm like, why is his fastball good? I'm trying to think. I think, so today, averaged over 2,600 RPMs on his fastball. That's like well above league average. And, you know, I won't make any, like, I won't speculate about, like, is he using sticky stuff? Whatever.
I was going to bring that up. How many RPM on his fastball do you think he could get if we just ran him out there with a spider tack?
Oh, dude.
I'm going to say 5,000.
I mean...
10,000.
I would guess, like, my serious answer is I think he could probably do anywhere from, like, 2,700 to 3,000.
Legalize it. It's just rosin and sweat, bro.
It would be insane.
Okay, sorry, continue.
The other thing is that he's really pounded the zone. And, like, not only with his four-seamer, but, like, after his first start, his zone percentage was 55%, basically 56, which is above the league average of basically 49. Today, he was at 61%. And, like, his fastball zone percentage was actually lower than his cutter and his slider. He's really just, like, been pounding the strike zone. And I'm watching someone walk by my window with a Kelnick jersey.
Hey, yell at your window.
No, I have to, like, on the pod. I have to, like, turn it. My window sucks. I think there are a lot of things that are concerns that just aren't showing up thus far. And I think, you know, we want to see more out of the secondaries. But I think he's doing well enough with them that I'm just so damn excited about him.
Yeah, that's a big question I wanted to ask you. I've heard a lot about the induced vertical break on his fastball and really just, you know, the stuff ratings on his fastball. And that's the pitch that's getting a lot of attention, which, you know, it leads me to have a little bit of concern as the league starts to adjust. You know, a fastball, especially even if it's great and elite, I fear that hitters will start to get the book on the fastball if it's just one pitch. So do you think he has enough going with his secondary pitches to be able to keep the hitters guessing and not have, you know, the league adjust to him as he starts to make 10, 15, 20 starts?
Yeah, I mean, I think right now his fastball is special enough that you basically just have to throw enough of not your fastball to keep hitters off of it. I threw around the name Logan Gilbert a fair amount in the emergency pod, and one of the reasons why is he threw 60 fastballs today, and of those 60 fastballs, 18 of them were fouled off. Which is, according to my phone, 30%, which is pretty high. And I think that was the case in the last game, maybe not as high. You know, like, there are metrics like CSW that are coming out, and it's a metric because called strikes are good and whiffs are great and foul balls aren't as predictive. But, like, there are a lot of pitchers that really consistently throw a lot of strikes, and that folds in foul balls and balls in play. Foul balls are sustainable for some pitchers, like Robbie Ray, actually, and Logan Gilbert. And I think what that tells us about Bryce Miller's fastball is that it is like Logan Gilbert's fastball. It is special, and that he probably doesn't have enough of, like, a wipeout secondary that he can really blow hitters away. So I think that'll come. But right now, yeah, like, the Astros were really able to fight off the cutter and four-seamer. Supposedly, there's three shapes that he's got going on. He's got a cutter, he's got a gyro slider, and then he's got a sweeper. It's kind of hard to tell, honestly. I think, based on what I'm seeing, he's throwing a lot of the cutters and sweepers, and not so much at the gyro slider.
How accurate do you think that pitch classification is? I know pitch classification can get a little bit murky, and especially when it's three different shapes of one similar pitch.
Yeah. And I'm trying to look at, I think the best way to really tell is, like, I mean, I'm staring at Baseball Savant's site, but I think a better way probably is to look at Brooks Baseball has a nice pitch effects tool. I think really the good way to differentiate between a cutter and a gyro slider is to look at what is similar to induced vertical break, which is just like vertical movement without gravity. And yeah, like based on that, it does seem like he's throwing the cutter shape more, at least today, but in his first game, it looked like a lot more of the gyro slider. So I think he's probably not able to land the sweeper super consistently. But I just tend to think that like one of these really takes hold. And I imagine that it's something that doesn't move so much, which, you know, means the cutter or gyro slider. And I think stuff plus wise, like I think the gyro slider is probably the best fit for his fastball and you know, between that and his ability to command it. So it's pretty cool, dude, that he's been able to throw three quarters fastballs and pitch this well.
You compared Bryce Miller to Logan Gilbert, and I'm putting you a little bit on the spot with this question, so it's okay if you don't have the best answer, but I'm wondering how Bryce Miller mixes with the rest of our rotation. I think I've seen research done that shows having a rotation with diverse groups of pitchers, and you know, I think this extends to both the rotation and the bullpen, but just having diverse types of pitchers, there's a bit of a bonus effect in having, you know, different arm slots, different profiles, different pitches. So how do you think Bryce Miller slots in with the rest of our rotation in that effect? Is he dissimilar enough from other pitchers in our rotation to give us that advantage?
I really do think that like he's currently kind of a similar pitcher to Logan Gilbert. They throw out of pretty similar arm slots, and I think one thing that really separates them is just their height. So Logan Gilbert really gets down the mound, but he's still throwing like, I'm trying to think, 0.4 times 12. Is that 3 inches? You know what I'm trying to do?
Oh, dude, one of my biggest weaknesses is mental math. As soon as you said two numbers next to each other, I was like, I really hope you're going to figure that out. This is like me sweating anytime I have to like calculate a tip on the fly. And then I just panic and I tip probably like 50%.
Oh, just double the tax.
That's mental math.
Okay.
No.
Well,
can't do it.
It's about 5 inches, I think. And which, like, you know, and you think about that and you're like, that's really negligible, but it's not. Where, like, Logan Gilbert has really stepped up this year is he now has a splitter that he throws for a lot of strikes and a slider that he throws for a lot of strikes. He didn't have that last year. Like, it really was just his four-seamer. So let me look at his numbers from last year. Like, I kind of think, I think that he looks a lot like Logan Gilbert from last year, with just like, I think he's going to have a higher strikeout rate.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, that will be something worth following as the season goes on. I think right now Gilbert's spot in the rotation comes up right after Miller's. Am I correct?
I don't know, honestly.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's right, and I'll double check once we're done recording, and I'll just cut this all out if I'm wrong. But yeah, if you're saying they're such similar pitchers, I'll be interested to see, and this would be hard to tease out from the numbers because it would get so messy and complicated with other variables, but I'd be interested to see if maybe there's some evidence of decreased effectiveness from Logan Gilbert throwing after Miller, if they are similar, and maybe you know, within the same series, seeing the same hitters, they might be able to get a little bit more of a jump on Logan.
I never answered your question.
That's all right. I kind of just tried to answer it myself based on what you said. So is that what you think?
I think that it matters more within game than between games, especially with, you know, I think hitters have more time to do video work and I forgot what that machine is called that the Mariners have, but just like, yeah, different kind of stuff to prepare for individual pitchers, whereas in game, like the Rays are really well known for like having Ryan Thompson throw, who's a sidearmer, and then having someone go over the top. And I think that's hard to adjust to as a hitter.
Right. Yeah. The Rays bullpen situation, I think, is really what I was thinking about when I was bringing up this question, how they try to leverage a lot of different looks in order to like really squeeze out a lot more effectiveness out of their bullpen. But you're probably right. I think the effect is much stronger in game than it is across games, especially with the types of like video preparation and technology that teams have these days. I think those effects are kind of tamped down anyway. So Bryce Miller is a huge success story so far of the Mariners' pitching development, and our pitching development also extends to the bullpen. So I would like to talk about the current state of Los Bomberos. Do we know if that's what they're going to continue to be called this season? I feel like nicknames and stuff like that tend to fizzle out after a lot of the people that were originally there left. Does that like, does that nickname continue?
I don't know. I'm
say they still did the graphic for Matt Brash when he came in, when I was in on Friday, but it was Matt Brash only. So maybe it only, the nickname only gets inherited for, you know, players that carried over from last year. I don't know. We might have to come up with a new nickname for the bullpen this season.
They do it at the game still. And Munoz is down, but just like searching like from Mariners and then typing in Los Bomberos, I don't think they've mentioned it like on Twitter since last season. So,
yeah, I think they're kind of pivoting on the branding. We'll have to workshop something. I feel like we could come up with a cool name for the bullpen this year. And they deserve a name just as much as last year, because the bullpen has been incredibly effective so far. In fact, Meow Mix on our Discord asks, analytically, what are the Mariners seeing in these crops of relievers that seem to come up out of nowhere every season at this point? This year, it's Spire, Gott, and Topa. What are they seeing in these guys, and how are they able to utilize them so effectively? The Mariners are first in MLB in pitcher F4 as of Sunday when we're recording, and the next team isn't even close. So, Mikey, do you have any insight into how the Mariners have apparently acquired this ability to pick up relievers out of nowhere and make them leaf aces?
So I remember seeing a graphic, and it was essentially like, you know, overall stuff plus like, and how, when teams acquire players, like, do they get them to, you know, really become better or become worse? And I think over the years, at least according to this graphic, and it makes sense when I think about it, it's just been about tweaking your pitches and optimizing your pitch mix, which is a pretty easy one. Like, you know, if you go back to like 2010, there are a lot of guys that washed out of the league that if they would have thrown 60% sliders instead of 25, like, they might have been elite relievers. So I think that it varies. I don't know. Do you think it makes sense to just kind of run down the list and kind of like explain what they might have seen and what has actually changed?
Definitely. As you do this, maybe we can look at these three relievers and see if there's an overarching theme as to why they were targeted and how the Mariners have been getting the best out of them. Why don't you go ahead and start with Gabe Spire?
Yeah, so Spire's, I think, kind of an interesting one, because it's like, when I look at him, like, there's not anything that, like, really, like, wows me, you know, per se. But he's actually been, like, I mean, until today, I think he fell just short of some pitcher who I actually think, like, wasn't very good in terms of, like, a scoreless inning streak. I think the theme that you're going to see here is low release. Spire throws from about 5.5 feet above the mound, which is, that's pretty low. That's 0.3 feet lower than Bryce Miller. have fun calculating that in your head.
I'm not even trying.
Yeah. So low release, and I think in terms of like what the Mariners did, you know, he added run to his sinker, and I actually like just in looking, I'm not certain where that came from. Generally, you know, you do that from a slight change in arm slot, or you do it throughout from changing your efficiency. But regardless, he last year like was a pretty clean mix of like four seamers and sinkers, but mostly through sliders, and he just didn't throw the slider enough for strikes. So this year really de-emphasized the four seamer in favor of the sinker, which is now his primary pitch, is throwing a lot more strikes with the slider, and in particular getting a lot of whiffs with it, but he's throwing like a fuck ton of strikes with the sinker. Like I'm trying to math, 81% of his sinkers are a strike, and again, like that includes foul balls and balls in play, which sometimes balls in play aren't good, but I think the overarching theme that you're going to see here is generally speaking, pitches that move differently than your average pitch are good pitches. And so, yeah, started elevating his four-seamer more to really give hitters a different look. Basically, throwing the sinker about the same, but is burying the slider a touch more. So I think really just spacing out his pitches more and throwing a sinker for Spire. Not sure if you have anything there.
I'm interested in this idea of spin efficiency a little bit. You said that might be a reason why he was able to add more run to his sinker. Maybe this has been covered a little bit, but maybe you can just give our fans a quick explainer of how spin efficiency like creates that effect.
So it's actually a bit of a misnomer, or like Tom Tango would get pissed at me for saying spin efficiency. He prefers the verbiage active spin.
I would love to see the fight between you and Tom Tango over the most pedantic shit ever.
The worst fucking fight you've ever seen. The way that I think of it is 100%, depending on the pitch, is either perfect backspin or perfect topspin, regardless of what direction that's in, because it varies by arm slot. It's just a perfect spinning ball. 0% is perfect gyro spin. So like the higher the percentage, the higher or the more that the raw spin. So like we talked about in the Discord today, that Bryce Miller averages about, you know, 2,700 RPMs on his fastball. That means that if he's spinning his fastball around 90% active spin, that means that 90% of that 2,700 is contributing to the overall movement and non-Magnus movement. Are you following me? Is this making sense?
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I think this is helping solidify it. It is a very complicated topic, but I think you're helping solidify it for me, and so hopefully that'll translate to our listeners as well. Let's see, 90% of 2,700, that's about like four, right?
Yeah, four.
Okay, good.
So let's actually take that. Like I know that some people will call it true spin, which is like your raw spin multiplied by your active spin. So like, again, just doing phone calculator math, but that's like 2,400. So that is how Bryce Miller is able to create such an insane fastball shape, is he has a lot of, like, he doesn't spin the ball with perfect efficiency like Gerrit Cole, but he's spinning the hell out of the baseball. And so even though his spin efficiency is lower, he's spinning it, you know?
Got it. And maybe you can tell me if this is a good metaphor. So maybe we can kind of translate it to the idea of fielding and having great raw speed and getting a great jump on the ball would be analogous to raw movement. But then route efficiency would be similar to spin efficiency or whatever term you want to use to describe it, where there's a certain amount of energy you're putting into going towards that ball, and that's sort of your speed. But then it's also dependent on how directly you go to the place where that ball is going to be landing. So there's the raw amount of energy, and then there's the amount of energy that's going into moving the pitch in the direction you want it to. And those two things are related, but not necessarily always a perfect overlap.
Yeah, I like that. And maybe in other ways, like thinking of, like, I don't know, if you're sprinting in sand, I'm not good with physics, despite, you know, the baseball stuff, but like, you're not going to run as fast as if you have like more friction against the flat ground. But yeah, at the end of the day with Spire, it really just has to do with, I mean, A, yeah, that made his sinker more unique, his shape more unique. He raised the fastball height to give hitters a different look and have to account for the elevated fastball. And like, also that makes the fastball harder to hit, and then just threw his best pitch more. So pretty cool.
Okay. I think that gives us a lot to look forward to in regard to Gabe Spire. Do you want to move on and talk for a minute on some of these other new additions? Trevor Gott.
This is another thing, like, again, you're going to see this come up a ton, but Trevor Gott throws from about a 5.3 release, which is pretty low. And I think the difference between him and Spire is he really, like, I think it has to do with mound position, but he really gets out there. Like, he really gets out there towards third base. And for those who, you know, have been listening to the pod since the offseason, the guy that I was most excited about was Trevor Gott. And when I saw him coming in, I saw a low release, and I saw like four pretty interesting pitches. And generally, I think, like, I have an idea of like, okay, I think the Mariners are going to have this guy spam a slider more. I saw a lot of different routes. And I think in particular, when I looked at his pitches, the two that interested me the most were his riding cutter, which he threw like 91, which is by default interesting to me. And then his curveball, which he threw, I think, like low 80s last year. And what I said back then was like, if he can get that up to like 85, 86, that's like a Kimbrel pitch. Like, it has so much bite. It's such a nasty knuckle curve. Really, neither of those two things happened. He took his cutter and I don't know if he tweaked it purposely or not, but it's riding a little bit less. It's because he's not throwing it as hard. The curveball is actually less firm this year. And what he's done is actually just throw a lot of his cutter and his sinker, like mostly his sinker. Yeah, it's really just the same thing where Spire, where he took his four-seamer, started elevating it more, also raised his cutter height a little bit as well. But just, you know, like, I think when you have a good low release, like, you're going to have either a good four-seamer or you're going to have a good sinker because it runs a lot. And his four-seamer hasn't, like, if you look at his vertical approach angle, it hasn't really been great. Like, I think he served up a lot of home runs with it last year. And so by taking the four-seamer and elevating it more, again, you're giving hitters a different look. You're making them look upstairs, but also, you know, harder to turn those into home runs. It's going to be more whiffs, but then you give the cutter and the sinker more room to play. And the sinker shape is really just good. Like, he gets a lot of sink with it, gets a lot of run, and he commands the ball pretty well. So, yeah, the curveball and four-seamer or riding cutter have not been what I thought, and I wasn't certain what would happen, but I've been really pleased with, you know, what he's kind of posted this year.
For sure. I agree with everything you said, and I think the Mariners are seeing a lot that they must like out of Trevor Gott just based on his usage. He's been, let's see, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but anecdotally, it feels like he's been one of the relievers that they've leaned on the most. Maybe not in the highest leverage situations, but still, I think his usage pattern shows that the Mariners are trusting him a lot.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he's pitched an inning more than Matt Brash. I think even after today, and that's second on the team after Paul Sewald. So, you know, clearly there's something that the Mariners really like in him, and knock on wood, but he hasn't given up a home run yet. And same with Topa.
Perfect. Yeah. Maybe the last bullpen arm we can hit on is Justin Topa. He came in for the save today. Paul Sewald, after being used yesterday, I'm assuming was just was off today. Yeah. What have you seen from Justin Topa, Mikey?
Yeah, I think the first thing to name is just like, you know, he throws out of an even lower release. So, you know, when you're looking at vertical release point, he's about 5 feet. And so that's, you know, that's even lower than the other guys. With him, it's really interesting because looking at like Gott's spin-based movement direction is like 134. That's pretty low. Topa's is 205 on like on a clock. Yeah, when you look at him, it's just like low release, doesn't throw a fastball, extreme side to side sinker and slider movement. And I think the thing that actually I just picked up on today is this year he added a cutter to throw in between the two. And I think, again, we could talk about this to hell, but one of the things we talked about over the offseason is Brash didn't have something to throw in between the four-seamer and the sweepers. Probably needed a cutter to throw in between the two. He worked on that over the offseason for whatever reason. Doesn't seem to be throwing it. Hasn't particularly mattered because he's been insane. So I think, you know, again, it's another guy with just tons of sink and tons of side-to-side movement. So, you know, his slider slides or sweeps more than average, and his sinker sinks and runs more than average. Now that he's added the cutter, again, like it's something, it rides more than his other pitches. So it gives him something he can elevate a little bit more, give a different look. And also he shifted towards third base on the rubber, which if you think about it, if you think about what I like to call like synthetic sweep, so there's like raw sweep, which is just like the raw movement of the pitch, but that is also informed, like that sweep or run or whatever it may be, is informed by like where you release the ball horizontally. So, you know, if you're releasing from literally third base, you know, that's a lot of sweep for a right-hander.
Sure. So like you're saying, you can kind of exaggerate the effect on your sweep if you just draw a straight line from where you release the ball to where the ball is caught by the catcher. That can throw off the hitter's you know, look and timing even more than just how much spin they're imparting.
Yeah. So I think that's also helped a lot. That's you know, helped give his cut a little more cut than it would have had otherwise. Accentuated the sweep on his slider, and the sinker runs a lot. So even though it has to work a little extra to kind of get to like neutral, yeah, he's been really good.
All right. Well, all of this to say, it sounds like the Mariners bullpen is pretty stacked at the moment. So that calls into question some roster issues. So B asks, with the addition of Juan Thin and the potential pending return of both Murphy and Munoz, who do you think is most likely to be the odd man out? And who do you think is likely to continue their performance? And also, is there a possibility that any of these pieces get packaged in a trade somewhere, hopefully, fingers crossed, for a hitter sometime in the at the trade deadline?
Do you want to take this first?
It's a little bit obvious, but I do feel like Chris Flexen is already on the out right now. I'm not sure if he's even really being considered part of the bullpen. I'm not sure what the status of Chris Flexen is right now. I feel like he's just kind of in the like in the nether regions of the roster where we're just kind of forgetting he even exists. But yeah, based on recent performance, I feel like Chris Flexen is the one that's really on the wobbly seat. The other thing that complicates this is minor league options. And that's something I would need to look into a little bit further. I think even beyond performance, flexibility is going to be the major key with like who stays and who goes. And if it's going to be easy to stash somebody in AAA for a little while, that is going to play a huge role in, you know, where people go when they, when the bullpen ends up being shifted around.
Yeah, based on roster, resource, Paul Sewald, Trevor Gott, Chris Flexen are the only ones without an option. Taylor Saucedo has been very good, but has an option, is also the second lefty in the bullpen. Tend to think he's the first guy. I think Juan Ten is going to probably get moved up and down a handful of times. I don't really know what to expect out of him, aside from what we saw in his first game. And actually, maybe while you're going, I'll look up some of his metrics. But I think, especially with, you know, what happened to Robbie Ray, I kind of think they're going to keep Chris Flexen around. Unless they feel really strongly about like Emerson Hancock. But even then, how do you get him reps? Do you move Marco somewhere, whatever? I think they'll hold on to Chris Flexen. I mean, you could move him because his deal is up after this year. But yeah, I think you can make room between injuries and Saucedo and Ten.
Right. Questions like this are so hard to answer because a lot of these things will kind of solve themselves with time, right? There will inevitably be some amount of injuries. There'll be some amount of maybe regression for a lot of these relievers that we've seen perform really well so far. So yeah, it's just a tricky question. And ultimately we're kind of trying to see the future on this, but it's a good question nonetheless. All right, well, I think that's enough bullpen chat for one episode. Shall we move on to one final question about the AL West? Meow Mix asks, how long do you think the Rangers can keep up what they're doing right now? They have a great offense, but do the numbers point towards some regression coming soon? Do you guys think them and the Angels will still be relevant in the AL West discussion in a few months from now?
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like I've harped on this in the Discord. Corey Seager is currently hurt. Dane Dunning is now in their fifth starter spot, who I actually really like, but if he was not good, I wouldn't be like shocked. It's just, they've put together such a weird roster of like guys that I really like. Like, again, I really like Andrew Heaney. I really like Martin Perez, Eovaldi, Mitch Garver. But all these guys are like really, I don't want to say injury prone, but they have been prone to injury in the past. They have been hurt. And so like, as is DeGrom, Spencer Howard, Jake Odorizzi, Glenn Otto, Mitch Garver, Corey Seager, all on their IL. I just kind of tend to think that their starting rotation isn't healthy enough, good enough. I think that their lineup is playing over their head, and I don't like their bullpen. So my answer is pretty no.
Yeah, no, I agree. I know the Rangers are in first place right now, but I don't expect that to stick either. I don't think that's like the hottest take in the world. I think a lot of people are looking at the record so far and being like, seems unsustainable. Dude, our boy Brad Miller is still playing for the Rangers. I had no idea. I'm looking through their roster right now to try to come up with some things to say. Brad Miller still kicking around.
My sister used to love him, and I texted her the other day and was like, I forgot what I said, but I was like, yeah, Brad Miller's still, I think she made a joke about him. And I was like, oh yeah, he still plays. And also he lives however many hours like away from you. She lives in Texas. Dude,
so are you saying there's a chance that there might be a stray encounter between your sister and Brad Miller?
Well, she has we'll a boyfriend, set it up. But there is a chance.
I didn't say anything like that. I technically just said encounter. Yeah, dude, there's a lot of like Mariners from this era that are still just kind of like sneaking around, and I'll see every once in a while, like Chris Taylor, and he's still pretty solid, but you know, it just makes me think back to this time when it's like, oh yeah, we were running out Brad Miller and Chris Taylor and
oh god, dude.
Who else am I thinking? Oh, dang it.
Nick Franklin?
Yeah. Oh my god, is he still around?
No.
Oh man.
No.
Maybe we can get Nick Franklin to come on to episode 100. I feel like that's kind of like low enough that we might be able to convince him.
Maybe we can just go instead of like good guest, just like funny.
Yeah, I think it's going to be funny regardless. So,
I mean, episode 69, I think, was kind of disappointing. So let's make 100 special.
We've got to.
Yeah.
Okay, Mikey, is that all your thoughts on the division? I know the Angels have a series coming up with the Astros. Who would you be rooting for to win that series? I'm thinking about it, and as much as it pains me, I guess I would go Angels just because I see the Astros as still a bigger long-term threat, even though everyone has been, you know, salivating at the idea of the Astros being cooked. I still see the Astros as a bigger long-term threat to win the division going forward. So yeah, I guess in that series I'm kind of rooting for the Angels. Can they both lose all three games? That'd be great.
I think they can't both lose per the rules, but
yet.
I tend to agree. I think you root for the Angels there. Yeah, based on the Astros, I think, yeah, better being a better true talent team. I think it would be more fun to have a rematch against the Angels. And also, I just think, especially with their ownership, and all ownership is bad, but especially with the Angels ownership, I hope they eat shit.
You heard it here first, folks. We're rooting for the Angels on this podcast. That's the secondary team of the show, is the Angels. Yeah. Have you heard the new like media policy for the Angels, where people in the media aren't allowed to ask any of the coaches besides Artie Moreno negative questions? What the fuck is that?
It's so insane. I don't
even mean, you're not allowed to ask me negative questions. Can I just like do that in my own life? Be like, yo, I'm sorry, but new policy, you can't ask me any negative questions. You have to run it up the ladder to somebody else. You have to ask my mom negative questions. You're not allowed to pose them to me.
That makes me think.
My boss walks in, I'm like, yo, buddy, listen, you're not allowed to say anything negative to my face.
Can you actually make like a separate mailbag questions channel and like not have me in it? Because I don't want to see anything that I don't want to answer. And maybe we'll just filter it through you and Day.
Yeah. I'll take out all the negative questions. Actually, 90% of the questions we get in the mailbag this whole time have been like, you guys suck. Listening to these guys talk about politics and American culture is worse than punching myself in the face.
That's true. But for people who don't know, that actually we did get that one.
And I agree. I couldn't agree more. Hey, yeah. Maybe that guy is still listening and he'll have a lot of thoughts on the Seattle food scene.
Ooh.
I bet you he thinks it's great and he's got a lot of things to say.
Yeah, actually.
He is good at... Oh, well.
No, never mind. No, I don't want to say it. Oh.
I don't want to say the name of the guy.
The last thing I want to say is... actually, I have two things. One is the Seattle food scene is so bad, I'd rather punch myself in the face. And second, oh, yeah. Seattle in mid-May is hotter than two rats in a fucking sock.
All right. Shout out to Ichiro for that quote. Most legendary Ichiro quote. That one of many.
It's going to be very hot, by the way.
Yeah, it's going to be like 95 or something this
like
week, right?
Really fucking, I don't think, but like 70s and then 80s.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's going to be like 104. So I guess we should wrap up here and get ready for the heat. Mikey, do you have any closing thoughts? Anything you're going to do this week? Any big plans? I think I'm going to run and get some abysmal nachos that I probably have to pay $20 for.
Oh, nice. I don't think. Just celebrating a couple birthdays this week. Shout out to my brother and my friend Zach.
Love that. Love birthdays. All right, let's wrap up.
I love being born. So,
I would do it every day if I could. All right, so I have been Dustin Ryan. You can find me at Twitter, at Dustin J. Ryan. And you can find Mikey on Twitter as well, at underscore Kuya Mikey. You can find the pod on Twitter, at Never Sunny S-E-A. Wait, is that the right handle? Never Sunny In? Never Sunny S-E-A?
Yeah, no, I think Never Sunny S-E-A.
Okay, at Never Sunny S-E-A. And of course, join our Discord and our Patreon.
It's not right. It's Never Sunny In S-E-A.
Whatever.
No one follows us from this anyways.
I know. This is at like the end of the episode. Everybody stopped listening like, you know,
actually,
5 minutes
ago.
Can
we say something really important in the end then? No one's listening now.
Yeah. Do you have anything you want to maybe just like, like shit on some people? Like,
Here's one. I purposefully didn't scan something at the store the other day.
No way. Okay, the other day, I was buying a bunch of like starters for our little vegetable garden. This is the lamest thing to talk about. So the other day I was buying a bunch of starters for my vegetable garden, and anyway, I was like scanning them, and you know, there's just like a bunch of them, and I was like, there's no way they're gonna be able to tell if I scanned like 8 of these or 10 of these, right? So yeah. I just skipped like half of them.
Yeah, dude. Doesn't
dude, back when I was really broke. This is so dumb. Back when I was really broke, I used to buy dates out of the bulk section, and dates are really expensive. So I would just, God damn, I sound like such a fucking loser. I'm like my vegetable garden and stealing dates. But no, I, you know, the dates were really expensive. So I would just ring them up as like rice or something out of the bulk section, you know. And then one day the QFC employee like stopped me and basically like berated me for stealing dates, and I'd been doing it for really? Months. I probably stole fucking, you know, $100 worth of dates from this KFC.
Did you do self-checkout or
yeah exactly. You just do self-checkout and then you just bring it up. Well, he probably figured it out because I'd been doing it like 3 times a week for like, you know, months.
Honestly, so. This is what stores deserve for making self-checkout stuff and replacing workers. So eat shit.
Dude, that was my thinking too. Really? Yeah. I'm doing the world a favor by stealing from QFC.
I agree.
All right. Nobody send this to the feds. Let's wrap it up. This has been It's Never Sunny in Seattle. We will see you for another episode next week. Join the Discord. Join the Patreon. All right. Have a good week, everyone. Bye, Mikey.
Bye.